Next speaker is George Vinney, and I'm thrilled that I don't know how we conned him into coming up here, but I'm glad we were able to. George works with the National Cave and Karst Research Institute, which you will find some of their annual reports out there if you're interested about this organization. We don't have time for a full explanation of what that organization is, but it's a very interesting outfit down in Carlsbad, New Mexico. But first, how many of you know about this conference that's coming up in October of 2015? Raise your hand, please. Okay, now you all know about it. How many of you are thinking about coming to this conference? Please raise your hand. We want to estimate. Can somebody estimate that for me? Here, keep your hand up for a minute. Okay, thanks. We'll ask the same question after George's talk. Okay, because he's going to be promoting this a little bit. But anyway, George is the executive director of the National Cave and Karst Research Institute in Carlsbad, New Mexico. And they do all kind of cool stuff related to caves and karst and stuff. And so he's been there since 2007. And before that, he was for 20 years was a consulting karst hydrogeologist and presumably the leader of George Vinney and Associates. So please welcome George Vinney.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you for inviting me to speak to you guys this morning. I'll talk a little bit about the Sinkhole Conference coming up. The Sinkhole Conference, the proper name of it, is the Multidisciplinary Conference on Sinkholes and the Engineering and Environmental Impacts of Karst, which is obviously why we call it the Sinkhole Conference. But it's not just about sinkholes. I mean, look at the long title. The long title has meaning, and it was very deliberately crafted because it is about hydrogeology. It is about groundwater regulations. It's about groundwater protection, management, engineering, geotech. We have lawyers who come to these things and talk about legal issues. We have biologists. So there's a wide variety of topics involving not just the management issues of sinkholes, but the hydrogeology and the management work that's involved with understanding, preventing, and remediating these things in the proper fashion. The conference began in Florida in 1984, and for the first time, it will be co-organized with another organization, and that's you guys, the MGWA. And so your fall conference next year will be in Rochester in combination with the Sinkhole Conference. We always have a rich assortment of papers and proceedings. The proceedings are long sought, and now since the National Cave and Karst Research Institute has accepted management of the conference series, we are making the proceedings available for free online rather than having to go to eBay or wherever else and pay $200 for a copy of the proceedings. So anyway, it's a great conference series. People come from around the world to attend this, and I hope that many of you, hopefully all of you, will be able to attend. So anyway, why hydrogeology? Why are we mixing with you guys? Well, it's really the theme of today's meeting, recharge. When you're talking about karst, when you're talking about environmental issues with karst, you're talking about some unique challenges. You're talking about some unique situations, if not in and of themselves, but at least in their scale. And so as we talk about scale, we're talking here about 11 orders of magnitude of permeability that we're looking at when we're dealing with karst. So first of all, the distribution of karst. 1 week ago at this time, I was flying back across the Atlantic from Germany, where I was involved in a meeting. The Institute is part of a partner working on a world karst map project. This is the first draft of the map. You're the first ones to actually see it. It's already been significantly updated. But the dark blue and the light blue areas show the karst areas of the world. About 25% of the land surface of the planet is a karst landscape. And coincidentally, about 25% of the U.S. is also karst, including here in Minnesota, especially southeastern Minnesota, which I'm sure you can find without me pointing it out. So this is a global landscape, and many of the examples I'll show you in the following slides are coming from around the world. And I think it's important because we all tend to work in our backyards, but it's valuable to have a global perspective, to be able to see what's happening in regions other than your backyard, which gives you a greater predictive capacity of what may happen in your backyard as well. So why do we care about caves and karst? Many, many reasons, but this is the MGWA, and we're all hydrogeologists, so I'm just focused on one, and that's water. In this country, about 41 million people rely on karst aquifers as their sole or primary drinking water supply. And if that's not enough to get people's attention, you know, I'm not sure what is. So it's a huge number, and it's grossly underestimated by most folks. So what is karst? Whenever I give a talk like this, I ask two questions. The first one, how many of you prior to this talk have heard of the word karst? Okay. Now, pretty much all the hands went up in the room. 20, 30 years ago, maybe about 25% of the people would have raised their hands. The word karst was a fairly unknown quantity about 20 to 30 years ago. Now, let me ask the second question, and this is not to embarrass anyone. How many of you believe you could correctly define karst if I asked you to? Okay, not many of you. A few years ago, I gave a talk to the USGS and at their headquarters in Reston, arguably talking to 50 of the leading geologists in the country. I asked the same two questions. For the second question, of those 50 hands, only 5 hands went up, and they were all karst people. And so here's a landscape that covers 25% of this country, 25% of the planet. Now, as a hydrogeologist, and I bet this is true of all of you here, you know, we can define volcanic terrain. We're not volcanologists. We can talk about seismic processes, how earthquakes, how they happen. We're not seismologists. We can talk about fluvial processes, beaches, depositional environments. We're not sedimentologists. Why can't we do that for karst, which is a hydrogeologic terrain? And so it points to a deficiency in our educational system. And so part of the goals of the National Cave and Karst Research Institute is to educate people, including the educated, about what karst is. And so karst, and this is a simplified definition, forgive me, those of you who know what it is and may nitpick about some of the details, but karst is a landscape. It's a particular landscape formed primarily by dissolution of the bedrock. And the major soluble rocks are limestone, dolomite, marble, and then the evaporites that you see there, gypsum and halite. Now, a lot of people will also define karst as having caves and sinkholes and underground streams, and that's really incorrect in my view. Those features are typical of karst, but they do not necessarily define karst, and they are not present in all karst landscapes. But karst is a process. It's a dissolutional process, so that makes it much harder to visualize as opposed to saying, well, it's a terrain like mountains. Well, you can get a picture of mountains in your head. You can get a picture of a swamp in your head. You can get a picture of prairies in your head. But karst is a process, and so it's much harder to visualize, which is why many people talk about the features like sinkholes and caves that are characteristic of karst. In this photo here, what you're looking at is some karst from northern Vietnam. You're looking at some karst towers. Let me see if I can... Is this working? Okay. This is not working. Okay. So I'll just use this here on this side. We've got some karst towers. This plain in front is not a plain. This is basically a giant sinkhole. You see a cave entrance here, another one here. There's one hidden behind that building. But this is, again, a landscape formed by dissolution of the bedrock. Okay. Now, how do karst aquifers form? A lot of students here, and so hopefully get you guys ahead of the curve in terms of your karst education. Essentially, there's different models, different ways that karst form. I'm going to focus on one of the major models, which we call the epigenetic model of karst development. Fractures capture water. They move on down through the surface, and as the water moves through the fracture, it dissolves the fractures. And so we're not really just talking about water, but we're talking about water that's charged with CO2, with carbon dioxide. It picks up in the atmosphere, picks it up in the soil. And that weak carbon dioxide dissolves away the carbonate minerals, in this case limestone or evaporite minerals if you're in evaporite terrain. And it creates conduits, much like the one you see here. But with time, what happens, that conduit is much more efficient at moving water, and so it forms a hydraulic gradient around it, and it captures water from the surrounding fractures. And so it captures more water, and so with more water, it dissolves more rapidly at an ever-increasing self-accelerating rate. And when that conduit becomes large enough for someone to walk through, we call it a cave. And so all a cave is a big conduit. It's as simple as that. Now, permeability. The theme is recharge, and I'm going to focus on the key term permeability. I like the scale of meters per second, so I've circled that. Now, if you look through any of a number of hydrogeology textbooks, I've selected Freeze and Cherry, their book Groundwater from 1979. This is still current as of last year when I went to GSA convention. And I'm not picking on them just because this is, I found this with many, many textbooks. But what it shows highlighted is we've got, they'll show limestone and dolomite down in this range from about 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10, through about 10 to the minus 6, and then karsted limestone up to about 10 to the minus 2 meters per second. I think, you know, the division is somewhat artificial, and so I consider that all within the karstic range. So one of the things that's curious, though, as I look at this, is that karst is comparable in permeability to sand, and in fact less permeable, according to this, than gravel. Well, that's interesting. So, okay, let's talk about that. I want you to tell me which sinking stream you think is most permeable. This is the Danube, the upper reaches of the Danube in Germany. And frequently, almost every year, the Danube goes dry. The water sinks into the gravels, into an underlying karst aquifer, and there's a stretch for several kilometers where the Danube goes dry in its upper reaches. So now let's look at a stream of comparable size in Brazil. Okay, now, which do you think may be more permeable? Okay, now let's do a comparison if you're not sure. Okay, here in the Danube, we've got gravel, and the pore space is about maybe at the upper end about 5 millimeters. Here we have a pore space of about 50 meters. Okay, oops, got to be careful with this thing. Okay, here the water sinks underground over a distance of several kilometers. Here, the water completely goes underground in less than a meter. Here, if the water comes up about 5 meters, what will happen? It will exceed the capacity, the recharge capacity of the gravels, and much of the water will flow off of that region. Here, we can have, you know, the stream rise 50 meters, and it all very easily, very nice, gurgles on down underground. So how they get that gravel is more permeable than karsted limestone is beyond me. But I think I've made the point that karst has a very high range of recharge capability and permeability. So let's talk a little bit more in detail about some of these ranges of permeability. We often discuss karst as being a triple permeability system, which adds a lot to the complexity of managing and studying karst aquifers and often results in some misunderstanding of how karst aquifer works, some mischaracterization. So at the low end of the system, we have what we call diffuse recharge, diffuse flow. And so we're talking about laminar flow, moving very slowly, basically the water moving essentially through the matrix of the rock. Now, we also have fracture flow, and this is moving through bedding planes, through fractures, and the rock, as the name implies. Some of these may be solutionally enlarged. The flow is often laminar. It could be turbulent in some conditions. It holds a significant amount of water, aquifer water, in storage in karst aquifers. And then the third type is conduit flow. Now, I talked about conduits earlier, but let me define what I mean by conduits. Basically, a conduit is a hole that's more than about 5 to 10 millimeters in width or diameter, you know, the size of my little finger here. Why that size? Because at 5 to 10 millimeters, you have the threshold of turbulence. Once you have turbulent flow starting to happen, then a hole that's the size of my finger, hydrologically, geochemically, sediment transport, contaminant transport-wise, a hole this size functions the same way as that 50-meter diameter conduit in Brazil that I showed you just a moment ago. They all transport sediments very rapidly, contaminants very rapidly. There's essentially little or no filtration to these systems. And so when we deal with karst, it's important not to focus on the anthropo size, the human-sized conduits, that we call caves, but also to think about the little guys. We've all turned on our spigot, and we've got rusty, muddy water coming out of that spigot. That's turbulent flow. There's no filtration through now a thumb-sized hole. So we need to think about this when we're dealing with karst aquifers. Okay, this is a diagram from the ASTM on their guidance of how to work with and manage karst. And it shows various ranges of permeability and various testing methods of what you get, you know, when you study karst aquifers. And so at the far left side of it, you know, item A, you see these are the results that you get from core tests down in the range of 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10, you know, meters per second permeability. If you look at B, C, and D, you're looking at packer tests, slug tests, pump tests, and you're roughly in the 10 to the minus 5. A lot of textbooks describe karst as averaging, having an average flow of about 10 to the minus 5 meters per second. But then that box in the upper right side shows the results of dye traces, you know, where you put a dye, a harmless colored substance into the water and see how fast it goes from point A to point B. And that results in a flow of about, on average, 10 to the minus 1 meters per second. So we see this great range of permeability. And to put it within that triple permeability context I just talked about, here we're looking down at A. We're looking down at the diffuse flow part of the system. B, C, and D are more in the fracture area, and when you're E in the dye traces, you're looking more at the conduits. And so how fast does groundwater move through karst? Slow, medium, fast? The answer is yes. It just depends what part of the system you're looking at. Ralph Ewers, a great karst hydrogeologist from Kentucky, describes this diagram in kind of a reverse fashion. He says, tell me what speed you want, what velocity you want for groundwater, and with this diagram, I'll show you the method that will find it, that will give you that velocity. And so, essentially, you can go into any karst aquifer and you can get pretty much any of these numbers for the aquifer. Now, as we also look at this, pay close attention in that the majority of the range here is in what we would call diffuse and fracture, and a relatively small portion reflects the conduits. I'll get back to that shortly. Okay. Now, as hydrogeologists, we all love wells, but we should also love springs just as much. When you're dealing with karst aquifers, we need to recognize that there are some significant differences in looking at springs versus looking at wells. Any tool that we use, we must recognize its limitations, its strengths, and its weaknesses. So when we deal with karst and we're looking at well data, we need to remind ourselves that wells give us very site-specific data. Now, this diagram shows you some results from the Edwards Aquifer down in San Antonio, Texas. The map on the left side of the screen, you can make out these squares, which are about 1 square kilometer. And it shows the distribution of these wells in the Edwards Aquifer. So we're talking about the same aquifer for all of these wells. And, oops, wrong button. So anyway, but you can look at these hydrographs where you've got this orange well here. You've got a purple, blue, green, and another blue hydrograph down here. And they do not respond at all to that rainfall, at least not within the time frame of this hydrograph record that we're looking at. No response. These wells are tapping the diffuse part of the aquifer. Meanwhile, you've got this other well here, another purplish line over here, that you're seeing a gentle response. This is tapping some of the fractures. And then we've got a couple, a pink line and a green line over here, that show a dramatic and very rapid response. These wells are tapping the conduits. So what is typical? You know, there is, when you're talking about karst, it is hard to say what is typical. And so if you think about characterizing flow, chemistry, groundwater age, and then relating that to contaminant transport, water supply, you're dealing with a complex issue, a very complex sort of behavior in an aquifer. Now, if you're looking at springs, springs characterize drainage basins. Wells tell you what's happening right around the well. But if you want to know what's really happening in the aquifer, you need to look at springs. Now, this is from South Central Kentucky. And it's a series of dye tracing. And, you know, the red lines show the dye paths. The blue show you some of the springs where the dye flows to. And if you can make out the green groundwater drainage basin boundaries, that shows you the drainage basin. So let's say if you monitor this spring, and I apologize to those of you on my left side because, you know, it's kind of, there we go, try to be better about this. Be fair to both sides of the room. If you look at this at this spring over here, what it's doing is all of the water, whether it's conduit, diffuse, or fracture, all the water within that drainage basin is coming out by definition at that spring. And so if we can tease apart the hydrograph data, the chemistry data of that spring, we can characterize then the conduit, diffuse, and fracture portions of that aquifer. Now, too much of a big picture thing for you? Well, okay, let's focus in. We see that, come on, there we go. I've lost my dot here. Let me try over here. Okay, so let's focus over here. We can go up the drainage basin to where we have a cave stream here that we can access. And so we can then study a smaller part of that drainage basin because that cave stream, that conduit, is now capturing the drainage for that area upstream of it. And again, the diffuse, the fracture, and the conduit flow is coming to that location. So karst aquifers in many ways function much like stream networks in that, you know, the water goes from the smaller rivulets down to the larger trunk passages or channels. Now, a lot of times people will say, okay, George, you know, we get it. You're a conduit guy. You're into caves. But they don't hold that much water. You know, get real. You know, most of the water in the aquifer is not being held in the conduits. So how much water really is held in the conduits? Well, there was a study done, very important study done in 2000. And what the authors did, they looked at a broad cross-sections of karst aquifers. They looked at the chalk aquifers in England. They looked at these high porosity aquifers down in the Yucatan, these tertiary limestones that have never been buried. They looked at some dense Mississippian limestones from the central U.S. And they compared in detail behavior between these aquifers, and they found amazingly similar results. And what they found was that only about 6% of the water in the aquifer is stored in the conduits. Not in the caves, but in the conduits, this size and bigger. And it's like, okay, that makes sense. But that's how much 6% is stored in the conduits at any given point in time. More significantly, though, if you look at how much water moves through the conduits over time, what you find is that 99% of the water moving through an karst aquifer over time is moving through the conduits. In other words, the stuff that's in the fractures, the stuff that's in the matrix, is sitting there. It's moving, but it's moving slowly, and so most of the flow in karst aquifers is moving through the conduits. And so if it feels like I'm emphasizing the conduits, I am. That's where the action is happening. You know, I think it would be a great disservice for any hydrogeologist to ignore the fractures, to ignore the matrix, but it would be a greater disservice to underplay the conduits, where all the action is really, really happening. So now let's talk about we'll focus the rest of this time on the implications, the environmental implications of these ranges of permeability that we see in karst aquifers. What we have is, we'll focus on three topics. First, we'll start on groundwater quality. Karst aquifers are the most vulnerable to contamination of any other type of aquifer on the planet. It's as simple as that. Here you see, on the left, you see a cave in Greece. That black sludge that you see down in the foreground that the guy is looking at is water. It has all sorts of manure washed in. You see all sorts of trash washed in. It's horrible water quality. It does go off to a spring that has to be heavily, heavily treated to be drinkable. The fact that you see him in the cave shows that he can contaminate the aquifer. I mean, I've been swimming in many people's water supplies. I'm a giant contaminant. I did not get filtered out. Okay, so think about this. You know, think about what that means in terms of filtration. There's a lot of pollutants, a lot smaller than I am, that can make it into these aquifers without any difficulty. The photo on the right, if this friend of mine took one step forward, he could become recharged into the aquifer and drop about 20 meters, and again, another giant contaminant. Now, we tend to look at the water and say, well, yeah, it's just some mud going on down. Yeah, but what you don't see in that is the oils, grease, chemicals, and so forth that is going down with it. And of course, a lot of these chemicals like to adsorb onto these silts, onto these sediments, then get carried and transported through these aquifers as well. So so we see this incredible range of upper range of permeability and how easily these systems can become contaminated. Karst aquifers are the only type of aquifer on the planet that I know of that can be contaminated directly by solid waste. I have been down in a number of aquifers pulling out car bodies, batteries, barrels, all sorts of garbage directly from the aquifer. And so the photo on the left shows shows a bit of a car body and some other trash that completely fills up a cave. The photo on the right is a cave, another cave in Greece, where someone just bulldozed in trash and dirt and God knows what else, you know, to help. They were trying to fill this in so it wouldn't be a problem for the neighborhood. But, and this is a very important but, conduit size is not a factor in preventing contamination. Conduit size is not a factor in preventing contamination. The map here is a cave I'd worked in down in San Antonio. Genesis Cave is the deepest cave in the county. And the entrance, it has a very narrow entrance. Right here, it says entrance pit. It's barely big enough to squeeze through. It drops down about 5 or 6 meters. Nearby is a sinkhole, 2-3 meters in diameter, filled with some sediment. And according to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, they have their geological assessment procedures to protect the aquifer from contamination. And they say, yes, we see these obvious karst features. They are big. They are caves. Let's protect them. And so they will wrap an area around it that captures the drainage that goes into the feature, and they say, aha, we've now protected the aquifer. It's a good start, but not quite that good. Because if you're in this cave and many others, within 10, 20 minutes of a rainfall, water will start pouring and shooting into that cave from all sorts of fractures and conduits all over the place, capturing water from a much larger area than what we see at the entrance. In fact, as you walk through this area, you don't see any other sinkholes. You don't see any other cave entrances. You see some cracks in the ground like you see anywhere else. You see some soil cover, and yet the water's very quickly moving on down through here. And if you sample that water, you're seeing essentially no difference in the chemistry between the water you're sampling underground to the water that's up on the surface. So it's very important to remember that just because you don't see the conduits doesn't mean that they're not there, doesn't mean that they're not having a significant effect. Now, neither is the absence of caves and sinkholes in terms of preventing contamination. So here's an example of a dye trace I did a few years ago. Picked an area, an inner stream area, flat, no caves, no sinkholes, just some soil, and I dug down 10 centimeters, and 1 square meter into the soil. And I just dug that much only to hold the water and to hold the dye in place. And so if you look, you'll see a hose coming here that brings water down into that. And so the recharge rate was 2 liters per minute. Okay, how long did we let the hose run? Well, we let it run for 1 month, which means 86,400 liters, basically in English units, about 23,000 gallons. That little 10 centimeter by 1 square meter hole never overflowed. It just kept taking the water quite nicely. Again, this was a randomly selected location in the karst. The dye showed up at a well about 2 or 3 kilometers away. And there was no evidence of any problem, so to speak, in this location. So by Texas state standards, and this was the dye trace I did in Texas, you know, you could put a gas station on top of here. Not a problem. No karst features, nothing to worry about. Missing the basic, the fundamental idea that it is the recharge zone for the aquifer, and the recharge zone by definition is the area where water goes into the aquifer. And so it's all permeable, and if it's karst, it's all vulnerable. So let me give you yet another example, though, that caves, the absence of caves and sinkholes is not necessarily significant. In May of 2000, in Walkerton, Ontario, Canada, well number 7 was contaminated with E. coli. What happened? Everyone understood the basic picture, which was the farmer nearby. He spread manure on his fields. It rained. The rain pushed the manure, with the associated bacteria down into the aquifer. The chlorinator on well 7 failed, so the bacteria got through, and so we know what happened. But people were pretty much puzzled. They say, okay, in principle, that's what happened, but it couldn't have happened. Well, why not? Well, the folks from University there in Waterloo, they went out and they said, well, first of all, yes, it's limestone, but it's not a karst aquifer. And they cited the lack of karst because there are no caves and sinkholes in the area. And so they pulled out their mod flow and wrapped this circle around well 7. And according to mod flow, it would take 720 hours for water to move from this circle, from that red line, down to well 7. Well, as we know, it takes bacteria. Most bacteria dies off within about 72 hours after entering the groundwater system. And here we've got an order of magnitude greater time. And yet, that tells you that all the bacteria had to die off. It couldn't have gotten there. So what's going on? They were puzzled, scratching their heads. It's not karst. Well, a couple of friends of mine who are karst hydrogeologists there in Canada, they went and did a dye trace, Steve Worthington and Chris Smart. And so they went to well 9, and they put some dye in well 9, and it showed up at well 7 in 5 hours. Now, one of the things that the Waterloo folks also missed was the fact that you've got this spring here, a site of focused discharge of a significant amount of water. That should have suggested that maybe you have some karst-like conditions here, but they missed that. And I'm not really harassing them, because, as I pointed out, most of us are not really well-educated in karst. So it's easy to overlook that. Now, Steve and Chris also then went to well 6 in the lower right corner. And according to ModFlow, it should have taken like 1,400 hours for water to go from well 6 to well 7, if it goes there at all. And it did in only 26 hours. They put a camera down the well, down well 7, and what they found was conduits, little finger-sized conduits, just bringing water into that well at a nice, steady rate. No big caves. We don't need big caves to contaminate an aquifer, to rapidly move those contaminants in. And why am I and many other people who work in karst so passionate? Because this is one example. 7 people died. 2,300 became severely ill. As I understand, many of these people needed new kidneys and livers. So no one's to blame. The Waterloo people aren't to blame. The water managers in the Walkerton area are not to blame for this situation. But if they would have been better educated, if they would have understood the vulnerability of karst, if they would have understood that even though there are not caves and sinkholes, this is still a karst aquifer, maybe they would have had a backup chlorinator that would have automatically taken over for the other one. Maybe they would have had an alarm system to notify that, hey, there's something wrong and shut this thing down. There may have been some other precautions in place that could literally have saved lives. And so It's one of the reasons I'm talking to you, and one of the reasons that I'm here again to promote the Sinkoil Conference. Because if you're interested in groundwater and related issues, not just sinkholes, I encourage you. Rochester, it's only an hour's drive. I was just there yesterday. A lovely city, lovely conference facilities. I encourage you to come, share your knowledge, learn from us as well. We learn from each other. That's why we're all here, to learn from each other. So please, please, come down to Rochester October 5th through the 9th, 2015. Sinkholeconference.com for more information. We'll have registration up later this year. So anyway, moving onward. Let's look at some other environmental implications, and that is with regard to groundwater movement. This cartoon drawing shows you a typical porous media type aquifer, something we're all familiar with. If there's a leak from this contaminant site, let's call it a landfill or whatever it might be, the water moves pretty vertically down through the vadose zone, gets to the water table, and then forms this nice plume. And we use our monitoring wells to identify the plume through what we all call a one up, three down. One monitoring well up gradient as a background, and three monitoring wells down gradient to detect the plume. And that works quite nicely in most aquifers, except when you're dealing with karst. So here's an example from the Department of Natural Resources in Missouri showing you a karst system. And let's say that in this case, for lack of just coincidence or handy example, we've got this house and they've got a septic system and the tank fails. And you see where the red line comes away from that tank. At the surface is flat. You know, nothing to worry about there, except there's a buried sinkhole under that soil, or here in Minnesota, under glacial till. And so the water finds its way on down. It works its way down. It may skip over. You see an arrow kind of goes up over a hump. One thing to think about with karst is complicated groundwater flows. Normally, the water may go in one direction, but during high flow events, the water may rise on up and find another conduit that drains to a completely different drainage basin. And so it can take the water to some unexpected locations. And so depending on the water levels, it may go a variety of different locations. Some of it may leak on down and trickle out toward the spring. Some of it may go straight down to the water table and be pumped up by the very people who introduce the contaminant. Gradients in karst aquifers are really, groundwater gradients are really tough to map at a detailed scale. And so it could be that your up gradient monitor could in fact capture the contaminant. Whereas, here, I forgot to put them in there. There's your random set of four wells. Your down gradient wells could completely miss it. And we've seen this many, many times with a number of dye tracers. You have your monitoring wells here, and your dye just shoots right past them. Your monitoring wells show clean results, but if you monitor down gradient, it's showing you that the contaminants have gotten there. So this is, again, showing you the range of permeabilities in karst aquifers. And so if I'm going to be placing monitoring wells in a karst system, and I don't get much water returned to that well, I'm not going to include that well in my monitoring network. I'm going to look for a well that has a good water return that's actually capturing a significant amount of flow that gives me greater confidence that it's representative of actually capturing a significant part of that drainage basin. So other examples of contaminant movement. Let's say we're out somewhere on 35W. It's raining, truck flips over, dimethyl ethyl double death goes pouring on down toward the cave or a sinkhole. In this case, let's just say it's gasoline. Nice elm apple floats up to the top, and so we can see with the brown line, you know, all the bad stuff floating into the karst aquifer being recharged along with the water. Well, water levels go down, and we end up having some trapped product, you know, left in the karst system. And some of it will literally coat, like a bathtub ring, will coat the walls and ceilings and slowly release on down. And you say, okay, we'll wait a little bit of time and that will flush on through. Yeah, it will. It will, given enough time. But I've also worked on projects where, there was one project, for instance, in Kentucky I worked on with the EPA, a Superfund project, where they watch contaminant levels go down and down and down and down in the spring and say, time to pull out. And I said, no, it's not. You know, it's not time to pull out, you know, because wait until it rains. And so next time it rains, what it does is it flushes more of the bathtub ring off, but also it will find contaminants trapped here in high-level conduits on ledges and capture those and flush those out. And then with subsequent storms, and depending on how big the initial storm was, you may have quite a bit of product that may be pushed up into fractures or in bedding planes that may take many years, many recharge events to slowly be flushed out. So we can't be enamored with a big conduit and say, yes, here's the big hole in the ground, everything is moving through it quickly, but you can have storage on ledges, but also into the less permeable parts of the aquifer that can then trickle out these contaminants for a prolonged period. So we need to keep in mind not just the conduits, but all levels of permeability that exist within these karst systems. So I said 11 orders of magnitude. Here we're looking at water recharging the aquifer at a rate of 9.8 meters per second per second. This is a cave in Lebanon that captures a surface stream. If you notice here, there are some dots there, people for scale. And so we're talking about water plunging at that rate, 80 meters through the vadose zone, straight down to the water table. I've never seen a gravel aquifer quite recharge at that rate. So anyway, you have, now we're talking about water quantity in karst aquifers. So you have this great capacity to rapidly recharge karst aquifers. But these big holes also allow you to rapidly discharge water from these aquifers. This is also in Lebanon, several kilometers away from the cave on the right. And so when you're trying to store water for long-term management purposes, if you're trying to enhance recharge into karst aquifers to have more of a water supply, especially if you're out west like where I am, and water volume is a critical issue, it's a tricky job with karst. If you're dealing with a shallow gravity-drained aquifer, such as the one I'm showing here, you know, you're really not going to have much success in storing a significant amount of water. Now, if you've got a deep confined system, you can store a little bit more water and have a little bit more success with it, but don't expect, you know, tremendous extra yields, because again, you're putting water through large conduits and it's really hard to keep it there for very long. You know, your frictional forces are low and water movement is rapid and easy. So let's flip this around in terms of water quantity a little bit and talk about finding water. One of the challenges in karst aquifers is drilling to find water, and it's very common for people to drill, and they say, well, wait a minute, you know I'm below the water table, and yet I've got a dry well here. What's going on? It actually makes some people wonder. And for many years, there was a debate, you know, could you even define water tables for karst? And yes, you can. But what's happening is the dry well that you're seeing on this diagram, it's basically tapping the diffuse part of the system. Give it enough time, a few days, a few months, weeks, whatever it might be, and it will fill with water and right up to, you know, your water table line there. It's just tapping a very slow flow, low permeability part of the system, while your other wells are tapping fractures and conduits, and they're doing a better job. Mischaracterization oftentimes happens, I find, with karst aquifers. The well that you see, the deep well on the left, I've seen many situations where people will drill, it's dry, and then suddenly they have water, and the water rises up the borehole, and they say, wow, we've hit an artesian aquifer. It's not artesian. It's just that you're drilling through this low permeability part of the system, which if you stopped before hitting that conduit or fracture, would have filled up eventually. And now you've hit this high permeability part of the system where water can rapidly rise on up and meet its water table. So again, it's important when working with karst to think about the ranges of permeability and what this means in terms of your interpretation, actions, management of that water supply. Okay, karst flooding, flipping it around a little bit more. We've got, this is a case we worked on down in Guatemala. The village of Las Cruces, which is down here at the corner of this drainage basin, takes water, obviously down there. There's a small stream that becomes larger and it disappears down to a cave. But what happened is deforestation. This is a false color infrared image. The red areas show where the forest has been removed. As a result, more runoff. And so the town gets flooded up to 3 meters deep. What you're looking here, though, is not from the cave overflowing. The cave did overflow because it couldn't take that much water. And there's a tendency to think, well, maybe it got plugged up. Like I say, that's why I'm showing this photo. This is a part of town over a topographic divide where water level rose out of wells and flooded the village because of so much water ramming its way down to this cave. So karst flooding is an issue that we need to certainly be aware of. You can also have sinkholes that may be flooded due to sedimentation through agriculture, compaction of sediments, excess sediments moving down into these systems. In urban areas, a similar situation like in Guatemala, where you have increased runoff that leads that goes down to the into the sinkhole, even if its capacity has not been decreased. And also in urban settings, you have the situation where you have growth and development in the sinkholes. Those sinkholes are basically floodplains for the karst aquifer. And if you decrease the size of the floodplain, the water level is going to go higher and cause flooding problems. So a variety of issues related to the permeability of karst and land use around it. Now, we can also change permeability as well and have an impact. And so in this case, in this cartoon, what we see is a cave stream, and we see a bunch of sinkholes overhead. It flows on down during base flow conditions quite nicely, moves through a collapse pile without any difficulty. And water, of course, recharges down through a variety of sinkholes and fractures and what have you. Now, during flood flow, what happens is we have recharge through the sinkholes, but the sinkhole at the far left has a constriction. And so there's a lot of ponding in this sinkhole, and it will slowly release its water down underground. Except now you've decided that you want to move in there. You want to put in a housing development. You want to put in a road. You want to put in a mall for teenage mating rituals. Other important things of society. And so you don't want this pond, you know, in your backyard. So what you do is you drill a drainage well. You enhance the permeability. You clear out that blockage. But as a result, because of your work and other people's, you're enhancing recharge into the system. And so the flood pulse going downstream is higher, and some of the buildings that were in sinkholes that normally would not get flooded are now getting flooded. And the way this cartoon is drawn, the sinkholes are obvious, but in many situations, the sinkholes are not obvious. We're talking about broad, very shallow features, and oftentimes people don't even realize that they're living or building in a sinkhole until the flood happens. So, last topic, and I'll cover this briefly, are collapse sinkholes. This is a hydrologic issue. We're talking about recharge, and so that's what I'm going to focus on. There are natural sinkholes, there are induced sinkholes. The difference between the two is an induced sinkhole is where human activity enhances, exacerbates, whatever term you want to use, some natural process to accelerate the process and result in sinkhole collapse. This is the Winter Park sinkhole in Florida that happened over 30 years ago and really caught national attention, and since then there have been many others. So how do these sinkholes form? The most common types of sinkholes, the one that are most destructive, the most common around the country, are what we call cover collapse sinkholes. It's not the bedrock that collapses, but it's the unconsolidated materials, soils, till, whatever it may be, that's sitting above it. And so, you know, the way these things happen, you know, in this example with induced recharge, you have some fractures, some conduits that may be sediment-filled down below all this material. But then you're putting water, for various reasons, in one location, which is enhancing recharge in that location. Right now in New Mexico, my crew is out in the field doing a resistivity survey along two roadways that have suffered some major collapses. And we're doing this partly as a science project from our end, but also to help the county rebuild the roads in a proper manner. What happens typically when you build a road, the good engineer is going to have little drainage channels off the sides of the roads. You have to capture and move the water. Well, now you're putting water concentrated in one location over and over and over, and it goes on down, and that's a favored location for sinkhole development. And so as that water moves on down, it starts carrying saturated soil, alluvium, whatever, with it, until you form a soil cave that becomes large enough and unstable enough, and it finally collapses in. And so this is the most common mode of sinkhole development. It's directly related to our topic of recharge. The other mode that we see is somewhat related. It's due to a fluctuating water table. Florida gets the majority of these types of sinkholes. And that is where you have the water table that's up into your unconsolidated materials. And then during drought or pumping, the water level goes down into the bedrock. And with it, the saturated material, the saturated unconsolidated material starts washing and flushing on down. The next year after a good rain, the water level goes up. Things dry out again. Water level goes down, more flushes on down. And so sinkholes form like this. In fact, we're getting into sinkhole season in Florida right now. Because typically what they do is over the wintertime, if they have a bad freeze, they pump their aquifers, they spray that warm water on the crops to keep them from freezing. Water levels go way down. And then usually sometime in the spring is when a lot of sinkholes occur. I have no doubt that many have already occurred in Florida. We don't hear about the majority of them. We hear about the tragedy, for example, with a fellow who died when the hole opened up under his bedroom and swallowed him a year ago. What happened in that case? It could have been sinkhole season that just got him, the fluctuating water table. It could have been a natural sinkhole, and it was just time. But the fact that it was right under his house makes me wonder if it was an induced sinkhole, induced recharge, maybe a leaking water line or a sewer line that could have been creating, you know, a sinkhole or creating this cavity under his house. We'll never know. I am thinking of using the Institute as a platform to try to encourage communities built on karst to consider their infrastructure under their buildings to minimize leakage and to prevent sinkholes like this from occurring. So if you're interested in more information about sinkholes, the great variety of sinkholes that occur, the various conditions, the hydrologic reasons, next year I hope to see you. I will be here in Rochester. If you have any questions, if we have time, we may not, but right now, but I'll be here all day, and I'll look forward to visiting with you. Thank you very much.